Let's start with the most recent news for you and talk about your move. You're all settled in to your brand new job. Can you talk about what you'll be doing in Colorado?
Yeah, so I am the new viola professor at Colorado State University. And eventually I will just be teaching viola students and chamber music and my studio class and sort of all things viola related. My studio is a little small at the moment. And so until I get a few more students, I am also teaching music theory. This is the first semester required class for incoming freshmen that everybody dreads, but I hope to make it not too painful. So
I love it. Well, let's go back to the beginning and start. When did you begin playing the viola?
So I started playing violin when I was five. And this is a pretty common story for violists and cellists as well, but maybe to a slightly lesser extent. And I took lessons. It was my parents doing, you know, this was part of my education and music education was part of it. And so I studied with Greg Boardman for a long time, from age five until maybe age 13. But when I was 11, when I was in sixth grade, we spent a year in Albuquerque. My dad had a sabbatical and that's where he grew up. My grandparents still live there. And that middle school had three orchestras in it, which was like mind blowing to me. Like our elementary school strings program was, you know, five people at the most. And I quickly made friends with violists and cellists. And this orchestra met always sort of during the lunch period. So they'd break it up into three sections, and it would be like violins would have sectionals and then lunch and then full orchestra. And violists and cellists would have lunch and then sectionals and then full orchestra. And so I decided during that year that I wanted to switch to the viola. And it depends on who I'm talking to. Sometimes I tell them because the viola is so much better and it sounds so much more beautiful. And like, it's such a, you know, an interesting thing to play the middle parts of the ensemble. But if you'd asked me when I was 11, it's because all of my friends were in a different sectional than I was in middle school.
Well, we all have priorities at that point in our life. But I'm glad you brought up schools, too, because as someone who still works with young people in arts programs in schools, how important is that how was it to your development and to the development of any young artists out there?
Oh, it's extremely important. I mean, music, I think, is a bit anomalous in that you come into an undergraduate program with like 10, 15, maybe more years of study on your instrument under your belt. And so you can't just come in and like decide to be a music major from scratch the way you can, you know, be an engineer or pre-med or something like that. And so, you know, having these programs in the schools in particular, you know, I have so many friends who started their instruments in school, and that's what, you know, made them really love the instrument. But also all of the teachers who teach, you know, private lessons to pre-college and younger students, you know, this is just the lifeblood of classical music, because you need to start so early.
Now, you come from a musical family. Was that an advantage, or did that, or maybe both, also create some additional pressure early on?
Well, so my family is, we are a family of amateur musicians, generally. And my dad was a pretty good cellist in his day. He still has his cello. And every time I talk to him, he's like, I've been meaning to take the cello out. And he hasn't, I think, been practicing in a while. But I think it was helpful in that they, and particularly my dad, could, you know, help me work my way through pieces, tell me when I was doing something blatantly wrong. You know, he'd come storming downstairs and tell me I was playing out of tune, which was true, and I didn't really care to hear it. But, you know, it's an advantage. I think it's often an advantage, because if you come from a musical family, they know the value of private lessons as opposed to, you know, just the school orchestra program, or, and they know how to get you private lessons, how to find you a good teacher. And if they're professional musicians, they know what you need to do to get into the college program that you want to get into. So when I was applying for college, I didn't really know any of this, and I didn't know that you were supposed to get in touch with the teachers beforehand and go take a lesson and like do all of this stuff before you took your audition. I just like showed up and took my audition, and sometimes I even sent a tape. And so, there's sort of all these things that are helpful to do because a music program is so different from anything else.
When did you know that this was it, that this was what you wanted to do for a career?
So when I was 13, the summer I was 13, I did the Portland String Quartet summer chamber music program, and this is something they had been doing forever. I don't know when they started doing it, but I started doing it. This was the like early 90s. And they needed another violist. I don't think I'd even heard of the program, but like somehow I was put in touch with them, and they needed a violist to fill out their roster of students, and they put me in this group playing an early Beethoven quartet. And this sounds, Beethoven is classical. It's an early Beethoven, so it's like even more classical. And if you say this to someone who knows a little bit about classical music, they'll say, "Oh yeah, that sounds good for a 13-year-old." And then anybody who's like spent any time playing Beethoven quartets thinks to themselves, "Oh my God, this poor girl is going to be in over her head." And this was the hardest thing I'd ever done in my life. There were techniques on the viola that I learned in those 2 weeks because I'd never done them before. And it was like the best experience ever. And I still listen to this piece, and I can like smell the rooms that we were rehearsing in, and it's just such, and I just have such a like special place in my heart for this, for Beethoven Opus 18 number 6. And so that's when I decided that I was going to play in a professional string quartet for the rest of my life, which isn't how it's turned out, and that's for the best. But
Well, you've been teaching for quite a while, but in addition to that, doing some wonderful projects. And I want to talk first about Loop, Ligeti's inspiration and legacy, which was tremendously successful. It debuted at number 11 on the Billboard traditional classical charts, and such an interesting idea of how that project came to be.
yeah, so that my husband and I call that our second child. That was my pandemic project. And I'd played the first three movements of Ligeti's solo viola sonata. So this is a piece, a six movement piece for solo viola, no other instruments. And Jörg Ligeti is really one of the like avant-garde, masters of the 20th century. And he explored, like he treats the instrument in a way that not many other composers do. And so technically it's very challenging. And I played the first three movements during my doctorate degree at IU, and they just kind of get harder as they go. And so there was, and particularly the fourth movement, that was the one where I was kind of like, this is the movement that's going to determine whether this project is actually possible or not. And I set up a practice room in our laundry room, which was like the far opposite end of the house from our daughter's room, who was 15 months at the time. And like I would just go practice while she napped. And I'd take the monitor with me. Like, however long she napped was however long I got to practice that day. So it makes you very efficient. Having a child makes you very efficient. But as I was working on it, I'd always heard that Ligeti was very inspired by Baroque music. This is sort of the beginnings of like what we think of as Western classical music. Think Bach, Vivaldi, those kinds of composers. And And I was always like, oh, okay, yeah, sure, he's influenced by Baroque music. And then working on this sonata, it really sort of hit home to me, like, oh, yes, these are the influences. This is how, this is the structure. This is, and like the harmonic language is very different, but a lot of the way he's like approaching form and sort of manipulating phrases is very Baroque, like very inspired by Baroque. And so then I started hunting around for pieces to pair with each of the movements of Ligeti. And there's not a ton of Baroque music written for solo viola. Almost everything we steal from someone else. And there's a long tradition of violists stealing music. It's just something we do. And so everything that I found, all six of the pieces that I found, were originally written for violin or for cello. And some of them, at least one of them, is very commonly played by violists. The six suites, cello suites by Bach, violists play them all the time. But you know, violists don't usually play Tartini. We don't usually play Corelli. And so, you know, I sort of went hunting through all of this music with the help of my husband, who has got his doctorate in early violin performance. So he was very helpful. But just started hunting through all of this stuff and like finding music that I thought had this thread connection to what Ligeti was doing. And then, because that wasn't enough and the pandemic was still going, I decided to commission a music from a living composer that sort of reacted to each of these pairs, so the Baroque piece and the Ligeti movement. And I decided that all of the composers should be performers as well. And in fact, all of them except all but one of them are violists. And this was nice because I knew they'd write me something that like felt good on the instrument. And so I found five pretty quickly. And then I was sort of thinking about, you know, who else I should ask. And one of them was like, well, you should write a piece. And it hadn't really occurred to me, but I did. And that was, you know, that was an interesting, like, composing is a completely different thing. And I feel like I have all of the sort of tools and knowledge that I need to compose, having studied music for so long. But actually sitting down to write is a very different thing. And so having such specific guidelines for what I needed to do, like it needs to react to these two pieces, and I want it in, you know, this length, and I want it in this kind of format. That was actually really helpful, having these sort of constraints on the process. So yeah, so I ended up presenting the program as a set of six, kind of six groups of three. And each group was Baroque, the Ligeti movement, and then the commission. And I did those in order of Ligeti's sonata.
Well, and wonderful reviews for it as well. And then a project that you released last year, Breaking Glass Ceilings, Music by Unruly Women, this time number two on the Billboard chart, for goodness sakes. And I like what you're doing too, in that, and you've talked about it in your work, giving voice to people that maybe don't always get that voice.
And this was a really fun project. So this was something that Dror Bytel and I put together, and he's a pianist, my friend and colleague at Notre Dame, and amazing, amazing pianist, and such an inspiring colleague. And that's one of the really beautiful things about like being a musician, I think, is you draw so much energy and inspiration from the people that you work with. And it kind of started that we just wanted to play a program together. And so we were sort of looking around for music, and he found Libby Larson's Viola Sonata, which is this incredible piece. It was written in 2000, 2001, something like that. And, you know, she's still alive and well and working, and she wrote this piece, and there's so much sort of jazz influence and all these sort of non-classical influences in her writing, which is a whole different kind of can of worms to like interpret as a performer, especially if you're a trained kind of stiff classical performer. And then we started looking around for other stuff to play, and we got to thinking like, well, all of these, you know, I was reading about Libby Larson, and she was the first woman composer to be composer in residence for a major American symphony. And it was like, how is it possible that the first person to do this is still alive, you know? And so we started looking around for other music by women who did something first. And so we have Rebecca Clark, and her sonata is very standard viola repertoire. Like you talk to a violist and they know this composer because she wrote particularly this sonata. And she was, I think, the first, maybe with another woman or two, professional musician in a professional London symphony. And then I arranged two other pieces for viola and piano from the violin, the original violin. One was Amy Beach, three pieces. And it's been a little while since I've thought about this program. Amy Beach was the first woman, I think, to be commissioned and performed by a major American symphony. I think the BSO Boston Symphony commissioned her and performed her work. And then Florence Price was the first African American woman to be commissioned and performed and by an American major American symphony, and she the Chicago Symphony performed her music. So those, you know, those two are much older. Amy Beach was born in the mid 1800s. Florence Price, kind of mid late 1800s. Rebecca Clark, I think, was born in the early 1900s. So it's a pretty big span of time, you know, but all of this music is just so beautiful and so colorful and evocative, and it makes for a really nice program in addition to being kind of a statement.
We're talking with Dr. Rose Wallman. Well, you've got such an exciting year ahead of you, the new job, of course. But also, did I read you're performing in Paris in January, and then what sounds like a tremendous project that we'll get to hear next year? Can you tell us a little bit about Becoming America?
Yeah, so that is something I've been working on for a while now. I got a grant from the Sparkplug Foundation to commission five composers to each write a 10-minute piece for a trio, so viola, soprano, and piano. And the trio is me, Dror Bytel, again the pianist from Breaking Glass Ceilings, and then his magnificent soprano friend and colleague Maria Brea. And she's based in New York. She does a lot of opera and a lot of new music, and she's just absolutely like mind-blowing. And I'm really excited to work with her. And so this project is sort of designed to coincide with the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. S celebrating it is a strong word because that's not really what it's about. But so these five composers are each from a group that has been historically marginalized by classical music, particularly, but you know, sort of society as a whole, in like in America in general. And with each of them, I asked them to, you know, not try to like speak for their community, but to just kind of reflect on like what this means for them, their place in classical music, their place in the United States, their place, you know, how like their family's history maybe. And so There's actually a pretty big range for how each of these composers approached the brief, which I think is kind of cool. So Nyla Nombuco is African American, and she worked with a librettist to basically like trace the history of, African American and the African diaspora in the United States. There's a movement about the Middle Passage, and there's a movement about Jim Crow, and there's a movement about, she sort of follows the history quite closely. And then Chris Dirksen, who is Indigenous Cree, she's up in Canada, actually. She wrote her own libretto and is sort of speaking to the environment and how we need to protect the earth. And it's sort of from the earth's like point of view. It's like the earth is speaking, which I think is really beautiful. Tammuz Nissim is an Israeli composer, Israeli American composer living in New York. And she also wrote her own lyrics, and really about peace and how, how we need to work toward peace, which is prescient. Renee Orth is Chinese American. And she actually moved to Spain a year ago. So she's now in Spain. But her piece is three movements long. The first one is there was poetry like etched into the wall on Angel Island in San Francisco, where most of the Chinese immigrants came through, right? You think of like Ellis Island, where the Europeans came, and then Angel Island is where the most of the Chinese immigrants came through. And there are just thousands of poems in Chinese etched into the wall. And so she actually found this book, this compilation of the poems and then the translations. And she used one of those for the first movement. The second movement, I think, is a poem from the Japanese internment camps. And then the last movement is a crowdsourced poem that NPR put together. That was Asian Americans' response to like the uptick in violence against Asian Americans during COVID, where President Trump was calling it Kung Flu and just all of this like really horrible stuff. And then the last one is Francisco Cortez Alvarez, he was a colleague of mine actually at IU. And is now working in Mexico City. And he chose a poem by, I can't remember his name off the top of my head. That's embarrassing. He teaches somewhere in Massachusetts. And the poem is actually from the perspective of the Spanish-speaking kitchen workers in the Twin Towers on 9/11. And so, I feel like every time I sort of talk through this, I'm like, oh my God, this is the most depressing thing ever. And I asked all of the composers to give me at least two different sections and sort of two different like contrasting sections. And I think, when you say it out loud like that, it sounds like it might just be sort of one big depressing hour of music. But I think the way the composers have approached it and the way they've sort of treated this material, there's a lot of resilience, there's a lot of hope, there's a lot of all of that in there. And I think it's going to be a really beautiful and really powerful
Well,
program.
it sounds, and I'm right that the overarching theme is that 250 years in, the American dream remains out of reach of some people, and yet something we still strive toward.
And there's clearly been progress and like there's steps forward and steps back and I think it's probably true that everybody is better off now than we were 100 years ago, and we just keep working.